Thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Stand up, my man.
Oh, hi. I knew that was coming. You should have got me a box. Now, I have spoke from a box. Thanks a little, Louie. It's been long gone. My name is Peggy Person. Today, I'm a happy alcoholic. I'm going to tell you what it was like and give you a little bit of my background. And then I'm going to tell you how I got here. And then I'm going to bring it right up to the present, which is the best part. Okay, I was born in Jacksonville, Florida. I'll even give you the date. I came along right after the Depression in 1934. And one of the things that happened to me as a child was my mother, all of them were born in Georgia except me. And I'm the only Floridian. And so when my mother came to visit her sister, I came early, and real early. And I came on December 23rd, just before Christmas. And so she wasn't due, so she stayed in Jacksonville with her sister. And then we, of course, went back to Georgia for a while. And anyway, I have a crazy mixed up life, but it's funny. My little mother had me at an early age, and she married this wonderful guy that was about 10 years older than her, and he was a truck driver. And when I was 6 months old, he got killed. And my mother was 17 years old with a brand new little baby, 6 months old, and that was me. And she remarried. And one of the most wonderful things that happened to me in my life, she married a full-blooded Indian Seminole. And that was my father, and the only father I've ever known. And he was very poor, but my mother was staying with her oldest sister that had raised her in a little candy store. And my father, Big Eagle, he came in there to buy licorice for the little children on the reservation. And he kept coming back, you know, and they struck up a friendship. And my mother said that I loved him from the moment I saw him. And she said I'd just break out in this great big old smile and gurgle at him and coo at him. And what happened is the joke in my family is that he married my mother to get me. And so part of my story is I come from a very spiritual background. And on the weekends, my dad worked off the reservation, but on the weekends, he went back, took all the monies that he had made, and gave it to his father, and he had some brothers on the reservation, and I always went with him. So I'm this little blonde-headed girl running around, little tiny thing running around, and no, I don't come from a pygmy tribe, in case y'all want to know. That wasn't the name of our tribe. And so I came up with that spiritual upbringing. And, you know, there was sometimes we had a lot of food and sometimes there wasn't. And the government agency had taken over. And I can get on my soapbox about the Indians got treated so unfair and all this shit. But we couldn't find a lot of food there. You know, we were on the Crystal River, and the tourists were starting to come into Florida. My dad was picking fruit from the orange groves. They were disappearing because of development. It was hard to make a living. And he was illiterate. He couldn't read and write. And so when I got 7 or 8 years old, we moved off of the reservation and where I went and stayed with my aunt so I could go to regular school. So when I was in fourth grade, I taught my dad not to just make his mark, but be able to hold a job by being able to print his Christian name. And he was proud of me. So one of my values was that he taught me was that I didn't have to live in poverty, that like they were having to do. that if I stayed in school and I made good grades, that I could get off the streets, because I lived off in a bad part of Jacksonville. Y'all would call it the hood up north. We called it the ghetto down here, because, you know, that's southern for white trash. And I decided the city I lived on. So I grew up in an ethnic neighborhood that are, some of them are still my friends today. I've outlived a lot of my friends. Well, I'm not that old, but I'm old. So one of the things that happened was we had Indians in my neighborhood. A Lebanese family became my best friends, the Cocobannies. And one of the things I remember about the Cocobannies, well, they had the little open fruit market and a little grocery store. Well, there were times that my mother needed a little credit, and because I ran with the Cocobanny boys, and I was always a tomboy, I ran around and played with the Cocobanny boys, he would loan my mother credit. And then when she would get a little money, or my dad brought home some extra money, she'd pay her a little bill. So there were times he really kept us from going hungry. He would send home my mother a bag of black-eyed peas that you could cook and make a big old pot of, or a big bunch of collard greens. It was nothing for me to be out behind the grocery stores on other streets trying to find food. And that's the poverty I grew up in. That has stuck with me, too. My fear of financial insecurities. It started then, and that's why I'm telling you this story. But we had value. You know, I had nothing materially. My first pair of shoes was a pair of flip-flops, we call them today. And I remember my aunt got them for me at the Woolworth store for 29 cents. And isn't that funny that we women look back in the last 3 years? I used to decorate my flip-flops when I went to school because I couldn't afford nice shoes. And now flip-flops came into style. You know, about 3 years ago, all these fancy flip-flops, right? And I thought, I had that style when I was a kid. You know, and when I saw these fancy flip-flops in the stores, I went, wow, my idea took off. Don't that sound like an alcoholic, man? They would take credit for everything. But it's the truth. Anyway, I did get a good education. I graduated from high school. And in the meantime, what I was going to tell you was, before I got that education, I was 14 years old, and my mother had a brain tumor. And she suddenly passed away. I mean, just that quick. She was in the hospital on Saturday. She was gone on Monday. And my poor dad didn't know what to do. He was a wonderful, loving person. He was the favorite of all the people in the neighborhood. Children in my neighborhood never went out without a Christmas present. He would start in January. He'd start carving and making little slingshots. I don't know if y'all, you know, kids today don't have the kind of toys we had back then. I mean, a toy to me was kick the can, you know. Somebody would find an old turnip green can, and we'd make a game out of it. I mean, we were inventive. And he made the boys slingshots, you know. And he made, when he would go work in the sugar cane fields, he would pick out the best of the weeds of the sugar cane, and he would make the boys pea shooters out of them. You know, where you put peas in there or hard berries, and, oh, they hurt. I can feel one hitting the back of my neck now. And so we had pea shooting wars. Now they got paint gun wars. See, we thought of it a long time before they did. And we played games, you know, and stuff like that. But he was just a wonderful, wonderful man. And thank God he was in my life till 1965. But he gave me my values. When I started getting interested in the little boys, you know, after my mother died, I went to live with the big aunt that I told you about. I won't talk about her. She became my mother because I legally adopted her. You can do that. You can adopt the lady you like. I didn't know that. And so I went to live with her so I could go to school and get an education. She had a general store, an old country store, so I learned business very early. Of course, when my dad wasn't looking, I was selling the pea shooters on the side. He never did find out about that. But I was telling Willow, who's visiting me, that I took one thing in my whole life. I went by Mr. Cocobani's store, and he just got in this whole big bunch of brand new, beautiful peaches. Lord, I wanted one of them peaches. Lord, I kept walking by there, not going to, I can't steal that peach. I can't steal. One day I stole the peach, and I ran out behind the alley to eat the peach. Well, I forgot that I was slob. There was peach juice on my little top I had. I got home, my dad said, "Who got some peaches today?" And I said, "I don't know." And I looked all around, you know, and I'm the only child in the house, right? "I don't know." I started learning to lie, you know, and stole something. My dad never was a mean man. He taught me to say what he means, but don't say it mean. He never did that man ever put me down. But he could look at me, and I'd sink into the ground. You know, just with a look. It was that respect and that love. And he said, "Did you take that peach from Mr. Cocobani's?" And I said, "Yes, sir." I was about this high. I've always been little. And he marched my butt up to Mr. Cocobani's, and he said, "My daughter stole the peach here this morning." He said, "She will be working for you for the next week. Whatever you want her to do, she can sweep out the store, she can sweep the floors, she can mop the floors, whatever. She will be working for you." And he left me standing there. I was so embarrassed. And I swept out the store for the next week. Mr. Cocobani was so wonderful. When we got hungry, because my father had that kind of respect and morals, he would call me over, and he'd hand me a bag, and he'd say, "You take this home." And it would be fruit. It would be a little piece of candy would be in there. And I think about that now that I'm older. We were the most fortunate of children in that neighborhood, and we had nothing. At 6 o'clock, when it got dark, mothers would start calling names, and you were in the house. You know, you were in the house because it was dangerous to be on the street. The gangs were starting to take over. And I remember what saved me was my dad was a warrior. I mean, he was a tough-looking dude. When it comes to machoism, I mean, there was nobody wanted to Indian wrestle him on the reservation. And yet, he was the most gentle of souls. See, to me, that's a man. He would walk away from more fights and try to talk somebody out of it than he would stand there and do it. So his love and respect of people in that neighborhood set us up. That from that day on that I cleaned Mr. Cocobani's store, we rarely had some little things for Christmas and stuff like that that meant everything. And I never lost those values. Even during my drinking, there were some things that I would have never done. And I know that about myself. And so I'm going to get into that. That's how my life was as a child. Oh, I was, you know, and when I went to live with Big Mama after I got my education, I always wanted to be an interior decorator. I got my license. I worked for Grandma, and she would pay me $10 a week, and I'd put $5 aside. She taught me how to be a good manager of monies. And she taught me that's how you get the money to get what you want. So I put all the money aside and went to interior decorating school. And then I met the man who was to become my husband for the next 45 years. And my dad had gone back to the reservation, and I graduated, and I went skating one night, And I saw this little sailor, Jacksonville Base was really active, and all the sailors was coming, you know, and this was in 53, and all the sailors was coming in, getting off the ships and going bowling and skating, and I went to the skating rink with my cousins. And this cute little guy with a cute little curl down on his forehead, and I was a cute little thing then too, and I didn't know how to skate. So I come skating by with my cousin on my arm, and back then they had them big skirts with the crinolines. I don't know if they all had them back in style one day. And I come skating on by, you know, and just fell just flat on my little butt. Kremlins went up over my head, showed my red panties, and my husband, to be my husband, said, "Yeah, I own them red panties." Honey, let me tell you something. I let him chase them panties till he caught me. 6 weeks later, we was married. Woo! Oh, and I even liked his tie. Oh, he had the cutest buns. And I even liked his tight underwear, even though they said U.S. Navy. I said, "Man, I'm sailing his ship from here on out." So, you know, we went on with life, and we were blessed with two beautiful children. And my interior decorating came in good stead because I always had to shop at garage sales for furniture and clothes and everything. And one day my husband looked at me. I had fixed up this dump of apartment that we got off base. And he looked around and he said, "Oh, my God, and this is all we can afford." I said, "Not to worry." I saw a garage sale, a thrift store off the base, not far from there. I finished up that house. You know, it's amazing what a can of paint will do. I painted the house and I found little cheap vases, and the Coca-Cola bottle didn't look so good. But the little 5-cent vase I bought did. Picked it up, you know, and it was real cute. And my husband says, "You know what?" He said, I think you could decorate a castle," he says, "from a thrift store." And I said, "Oh, yeah." And so this life went on. And we moved to Atlanta. My husband got transferred to Atlanta. And in Atlanta, my dad died about a year after I'd moved there. And it damn near devastated me. And the only time I can tell you I ever went into a depression was then. And down the street from me was a good friend of mine. And my husband was one of those that have a beer through 5 football games, you know, make yourself sick. Today, I think about that. My girlfriend drank brandy. And so we went down there to play cards. I moped around and damn near lost my job. I just couldn't get past my father's death. And I thought I was going through the grieving period and all of that stuff, and I was really in a depression, but I didn't know what a depression was. And I wasn't eating, I was losing weight, and I was looking pretty bad. And so my husband must have talked to Betty about it, my friend down the street. So Betty invited me down, and it was my day off. And she said, "Peggy," she said, "why don't you just have a little brandy and just sit here and talk about your father? You haven't talked about him, and maybe that'll help you get through his death if you just face it, you know." And I said, "Okay." So she put me an apricot brandy and one of those fancy little brandy glasses, you know. Honey, I just gulped that thing right down. There wasn't but about that much in it. And she looked at me and she said, "Is that the first drink you've ever had?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "Well, you're supposed to sip brandy." I said, "Okay." So I put my glass on. She poured me some more. And so I sipped it. And when she wasn't looking, I sipped some more. And I'm going down the street in my neighborhood. I'm out of my depression, honey. When that stuff went down, oh, my God, it went down. It was so warm, and it made me warm, and I got happy. The happy alcoholic was happening. I went down the street singing Jingle Bells and any other crazy song I could think of, and it's the middle of July. So that pretty much tells you I was pretty well on my way to a good drunk. And then being the periodic I was, we had a Christmas party, and my husband got some 151 proof of rum from Cuba. And, ooh, did I love rum. And he made a rum punch. So I had a little too much drink at Christmas. Then time went on, and it was a drink here and a drink there. But I can tell you, I always got that ha-ha happy feeling. Then when we were in Atlanta, I took this job as a bartender, as a cocktail waitress, and then I went to a bartender. And that's what I did for the next 18 years. And I didn't drink when I worked. And so I'm one of those garden variety drunks that it slowly, slowly I crossed that invisible line. And I started drinking. I think my drinking started taking off in West Palm Beach. And here's how I got here. We're living down in West Palm Beach. I'm working part-time down at the Tiger's Paw. And we have to wear these little uniforms. And I wasn't always this old. And I was cute. And I was the tiniest one there. And they had this rock and roll band that I loved. And on my nights off, I'd go in there and have a few drinks with my friends. And I was always happy, dancing on your table, dancing with everybody. And they had one of these go-go cages, because that's the music was in, disco was in, rock and roll was happening. And one night, some guy bet me $100 I wouldn't get in the cage and dance. So I said, "You're on, buddy." I went back there and got my Tiger's Ball boots. I put my boots made for dancing and walking. And I jumped up in that cage and did my thing, won that $100. I'm just so sorry I didn't have poles back then. I'd have loved to have run that pole. Oh, honey, I'd have slithered down that thing. So, I'm happy as a lark, see? I'm one of those happy drunks. And I'm still that way. Anyway, I'm back here in West Palm Beach, and we got word that we were going to have to move to Orlando. And I said to myself, "Oh, no, not Orlando." And I didn't want to move. I had a favorite bar to hang out in. I was making good money. I had a beautiful house that I just fixed up. And he says, "We're going to Orlando." And I said, "Okay." So I come up to Orlando, look around for houses, find something to live in, and my drinking was already bad from West Palm Beach. And what happened to me is just before we moved, I ended up in Kennedy Hospital with pancreatitis. I had got to that place where I would go on binges of drinking, like 2 or 3 days, and I just drank, and I always was functional. And they were so used to me dancing in the cage, they were so used to me being who I was, just crazy all the time and having fun. My boss didn't care. I was making him money, and he didn't care. My husband didn't care because I was making him money, you know, and I was still able to do everything. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I don't even think they knew I was an alcoholic. So I ended up in that hospital, and the doctor there diagnosed me as an alcoholic. And he told my husband, he said, "She will do this again unless she gets into Alcoholics Anonymous." Now, that's the first time I ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I said, "Well, I'll go to one meeting." And I went to a speaker's meeting. And that woman was standing up there just like me. And she was telling all about her prostitution and the drugs she used. And she was airing all her secrets. And I said, "This ain't for me. I ain't listening to that woman." I said, "If that's who's in the meetings, I ain't going by them meetings." I said, I'd be hanging around with them wrong women. And self-righteous bitch is what I was. And we move up to Orlando. And I'm going down Michigan Avenue, and I'm happy as a lark, you know, and I've been at the bar. I got a pocket full of pills from the doctor, you know, and I done popped about four of those suckers. And I done had a Slurpee. You see, I always stopped in 7-Eleven and got them big Slurpees and then poured the bottle in it, you know, as much as it hold. And everybody thought I'd set some Slurpees. I mean, don't we think crazy? And I'm going down Michigan Avenue, and I'm in a blackout. And then I thought, is this Michigan or not? And just about that time, I'm not paying attention, I hit the back end of a pickup truck. And it did a lot of damage to my car. I don't know how I did it. But I woke up 5 or 6 hours later with 3 police officers standing in my bedroom. I'm in bed. I got a headache. I got a knot up here. And they're asking me questions. I couldn't answer. I said, I don't know. I said, I remember going down Michigan Avenue. And she said, were you drinking? And I said, well, of course not. And my husband says, but she was on medication. He said, did you take any medication? I said, of course I did. And so she said, well, we're writing you up. And the lady's pressing charges. And so she said, your husband says he's taking care of that through the insurance company. So the next day, my husband was so worried. And the next day, I joined AA. And I found a meeting and I started going because he said that in 3 months was my court date and that I needed to be in a 12-step program. I also had to go to treatment. And so he put me in this fancy place. You know, I think it was called Brook Lodge or Brooklyn Lodge. I can't even remember. I mean, I remember going there because I was drinking while I was going there. And what I remember about that place when I got out 5 days later was the food was good. I've always loved good food. That's what I remember. I didn't tell him till I was 2 years sober that he wasted $1,000 a day. You know, I couldn't recall. But I was going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was going over to Friendship Group, and I was going to Blue Bottom. I started going to Blue Bottom, and I met a lady at Blue Bottom that took me through the steps, Fran. But here's the start of my other part of my story. After 4 years, I went back out. And I went back out, I know now, because I didn't do the deal. See, I kept the same God of not the one I have today. I still was self-righteous. I still was going to church. Don't tell me about God. I know all about him. I had all the I knows I know. I half-assed worked the steps. My idea of that second step was I ain't never been crazy, only when I was drinking. I had the steps all turned around. But I loved you people. God, did I love you people. So I just loved you people, and I got to socializing with you like I did in the bars, because that's where I felt at home. Thank God I got to love you people. Y'all saved my life. I went back out, and in 92 days, let me tell you, I lost my soul to the bottle. Lost my soul to the bottle. You know, I tell my young people, yeah, you can go back out again. Physically, you'll make it back. Mentally, you might make it back a few times, but you can also go one at a time back out there and never make it back. Never make it back. I went to meetings. I never left Alcoholics Anonymous. Never. And that's what saved my little fat ass. I drank and I came to meetings. And that's part of my story. And that's where my gypsy comes in, who's my friend. And I was going to Blue Bottom, and I liked Blue Bottom. And then I was going to all the other meetings he was going to at Hoffner and Friendship. And they became my primary meetings. Well, I would start out in the morning with my Slurpee, and I'd only have a pint in it. And I'd go to the do the early morning meeting. Then I'd go to the noon meeting. And then by the time I got to my 8 o'clock meetings, I had a great big slurpee by then, half full of vodka. I was drunk. You know, I was drunk. And I want to tell you, I was also unconscious most of the time. And I was at going to Friendship one night, and here's some of the stuff they told me I did. And some of it came back and some of it didn't. But I'm happy when I'm drinking, see? So I want to share more than once, and nobody cares. You know, I said, you got a topic? Yeah, I got a topic. Okay, what is the topic? Happiness, I'm happy. Okay, Peggy needs to talk about being happy. They never accused me, never pointed fingers. I'm telling you, there are groups that were around in those days, right, Gypsy? And Gypsy, I always picked on him. I knew that I could get away with it. See, because Gypsy was one of those that loved me and thought I was funny. And I'd say, okay, Gypsy, can I share? And he'd say, yeah. And I'd share, and then about halfway through the meeting, I'd say, oh, I forgot this other topic I wanted to talk about. And by this time, I'm slowing my words. And I'm saying, Gypsy, why don't you let me share? I'm slobbering all over him. He's got on his Billy Jack hat. Gypsy used to be a rounder, man. He was so cool. And now he's got on his little Scottish hat. He's still cool. And so I was just acting out and everybody was laughing, you know. Well, we had a big book meeting over at the Friendship Group. Now, in front of big book meeting that we had called the Friendship Group, there's a statue. Now, there's a statue of the Virgin Mary. She's about this tall. I'm drunk. I know it's a big book meeting because I got my big book with me. And I'm standing there and Andy said he peeked around the corner, heard me talking, and I wonder who I was talking to because the meeting had started. See, he peeked around the corner, he said, there I am telling that statue. I'm saying, honey, we got to get in the meeting. We're going to be late. And I'm saying it's a big meeting. And I'm saying, it says right here, rarely have you seen a person fall. That's barely followed our path. I said, we got to get in there and find where the path is. He said that was either the most pathetic thing he ever saw or the funniest he ever saw. But he said the good thing about it was I only shared twice that night. One of the other things I did scared my little mother to death. I was drinking, and I was supposed to be taking care of my sweet little mother, the one woman that was my aunt. I told you, I had legally adopted her while I still had sanity before the drink took me, thank God. She was my little enabler. And she was, you know, and I was trying to take care of her, and my drinking, this is during that 92 days. And she got up one morning, and she said, Peggy, she had tears in her eyes, and I looked at her little knees, and I said, what's wrong with your knees? She said, well, I've been praying for you. And she had rough carpet in her bedroom, and it had rubbed her little knees raw. I think about that now. She forgets me. And she's sitting at the breakfast table, and I have not fed her anything. I had drank myself sober the night before. Have you ever drank yourself sober? Oh, shit. Yeah, that's terrible. And so I was half sober when I got up. And she's sitting at the table, and she's having her little breakfast. And she looked at me when I walked in the room, and she said, oh, my God. She said, are you dying? And she said, he said you were dying on your feet for the meeting. She said, are you dying? And she just looked like she was scared to death. And I thought, huh? And she said, go look in the mirror. And I went and looked in the mirror. And I said, oh, my God. I'm going to tell you why. The day before, my mother had cleaned up all the bathrooms, and she put the blue tidy bowl in every toilet. Well, let me tell you what I invented. I'm always inventing things. I found out that if you float 3 sponges in the back of the toilet, you can get 6 Minotaurs in there. And so I didn't want anybody to know I was drinking during the night. So I was hiding my bottles in the back of our 3 bathrooms. And I didn't know, I didn't got up in the middle of the night and took my regular drink and went in there, looked in the window, and I said, oh my God, my mouth was blue. My teeth were the most gorgeous baby blue. On a white nightgown that was now tie-dyed and tidy bowl blue. I was so cute. I had this long hair, and it was blue on the end. And so I know what it's like to have blue hair. And I thought, oh, my God, maybe I am dying or I'm crazy. So what does a lady do? I ran into the bathroom and tried to brush my teeth, and it wouldn't come off. I stripped off the nightgown, throwed it in the laundry, and as I was pouring bleach in there to get it white, I thought, uh-huh, bleach my teeth. Poured a little bit in the cup and swishing it all around, you know, and I thought, God, that burns. I better add a little water. I added a little water to it and swished it all around, you know, and then looked, you know, and went in there and looked, and oh, yeah, it was gone. But I said, I got to get to the meeting. So I grabbed on my jeans and throwed on a T-shirt, and I started to the meeting, and my lips were swelling. And I thought, what is happening to my lips? And my mouth was burning. And by the time I got to the meeting, all I needed was a bone in my nose. And it was like this. And Brian come running in, another Brian that was coming to the friendship group at that time, a young guy, he went running and he said, we're going to have a good meeting because you can't talk. And so I couldn't talk. I went in there, and so I looked around for Gypsy and went over there and sat by him. I hadn't washed my hair, just my body, you know. My hair is blue on the ends. And I smell like a brewery. And I was going, and I was smiling at Gypsy. My lips wouldn't move. And Gypsy just looked at me. He slid over. He didn't want to sit next to me. I slid over. We just went right on down the seats. And he wasn't getting away from me. And so finally, Gypsy just got up and went in the back. And that's kind of how I went to meetings. So, you know, and I want to tell you something else. One time I was coming down here to a meeting, and this is almost the end of my drinking, where I am really out. I mean, I'm nutty. I come down to his Central. I hadn't been to Central but a few times, and they kind of frowned on you coming here. You know, there was a strict bunch here at the time. We were in a little house. And I came over there, and I call them bleeding deacons, and I'm still calling them bleeding deacons. I went over there to some bleeding deacon and said, if that woman's coming in here, he said, we might as well move the meeting. Nobody's going to have any peace. And I hurt him. It hurt my feelings. You know, even when I'm drunk, you could hurt my feelings. And I thought, hell, fart. I'm going to sit right next to him, which I did. I'm also a little vengeful when you piss me off. I sat right next to him, and I'd go, oh, he got so mad. I thank gosh I can talk about him. He ain't here anymore. I outlived that sucker. And so I was just really upset. And he kept giving me dirty looks. He started an argument with the lady on the other side of me. And there are nice people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the sweet little ladies, she said, look, She said, I don't give a damn if the woman drinks and comes to meetings. She said, who are we to judge? She said, isn't that what the big book says? She said, we don't know that we've got it made. And she said, as long as she doesn't disturb this group, it's all right. Well, about that time, I slipped out of my chair and made this clanging noise, and then I couldn't find my Slurpee, and it was sliding over the floor. I made a big scene to get my Slurpee. So two guys come along and ask me if I'd leave the meeting. You know, really nice, through the French doors out front of the little old White House. And so I said, I don't want to go. I didn't get up. Where's my Slurpee? And I'm drunk, you know. And they said, we're going to find you another one. And they're throwing me out of the meeting. And I get outside and I realize it. And I said, y'all are throwing me out of the meeting? And they said, yeah, you're going to come out here and sit for a while. And I went running around to the back of the building and I banged on the door. And I said, George, they threw me out of the meeting. Let me in. Poor old George, he opened the door and he let me in and he says, if you stay here, you got to be real quiet. And I said, okay, I like to George, and I'd be real quiet for George. And so when I left the meeting, I told George, I said, when I get sober, when I come back here, I said, I'm going to find him, and I'm going to tell him what I think of him throwing me out of the meeting. That's the kind of drunk I was. And I want to tell you people that y'all loved me when I was unlovable. You loved me when I acted out. And you cared about me. And you took me home. And y'all followed me home from meetings. And people in the rooms would call my husband and my mother and talk to them and didn't even know them and say, she's going to be all right. She is just drinking and come to meetings. And you know, I know that God was looking after me. He was riding in that car with me. My husband said it was unbelievable. I almost convinced him that there was a higher power in Alcoholics Anonymous. His van would be sitting on one side of the garage. And he said, I'd leave that meeting. I'd leave, go to the meeting drunk. And he said, I could pull in that garage with 2 inches to spare. And he said, it would blow his mind. And he said, I knew somebody was driving that car besides you. And you know, we sometimes don't realize the gifts that God gives us even when we're drinking. See, I believe that he takes care of us until we can get healed. And I got a wonderful sponsor. God has sent me the very best. Patsy came into my life in 1988. She took me through the steps in the little red book. She got all the literature. She had been on the speaker circuit. She was loving. She was caring. And she was kind. And she was funny. And she told me that the higher power that I needed had to have a sense of humor. And she said, why don't you take the one of the second tradition? She said, that's a loving God. He's your only ultimate authority. You don't have to worry about people in the rooms, whether they like you or don't like you. She said, if you didn't like the way you were treated when you were drinking and going to meetings, she said, don't ever treat another drunk that way. Treat the other drunk the way you want to be treated. And I got to bring up a couple of little highlights of my sobriety. In 1994 and 95, I'm going to give you some tough times I've been through, and I'm just going to give you one tough time, and then the second one. In 1994, I got sober in 87, and in 1994, I lost 5 members of my family within 17 months. I'm always wary of a 5-minute phone call. A 5-minute phone call can turn your world upside down, or it can make your world the happiest place you've ever been. 5-minute phone call, my grandson called, and he said, Mom, we lost Brandon last night. And I said, what happened to Brandon? And he said he died a crib death. And I said, oh, my God. And March, 1 month later, I lost my very best friend to cancer. And in June, I lost my favorite sister-in-law to cancer. In July, my husband had cancer. And I said, this is more than I can handle. I've been to 3 deaths. I said, this is might be a little bit more than I can handle. I went to a meeting and I talked about it. I called my sponsor and she prayed with me over the phone. And she said, Peggy, God will not give you more than you can handle. She said, you go back to basics. She said, you go to your meetings, double up on them. Read from your 24-hour book. Start on January 1st. Read all the medications until you feel at peace. I did that. That worked for me. Okay, for me. My husband did not die. And then my girlfriend had cancer, and she'd been fighting it about 7 years. She and I were joined at heart for 38 years. I never had a sister. She was my sister. She was my best friend. She had been with me since I was 19 years old. And her children and mine were raised together. We went through poverty times. We went through good times together. And she was fighting a losing battle. And she came down to see me for the last time. I was sponsoring a lot of girls, and she loved my girls. And most of them are, you know, have long-term sobriety now. But she loved my girls. And she looked at me one day, and she said, you know what? She said, I want you to do one thing for me. And I said, what's that? She said, you have a place to put that love that you've given me and everybody else in your life, someplace where it's needed. She said, these girls love you. She said, never give up your sponsorship. I said, I can promise you that. And then she says, and I'd like to see you do better with your health. I know she's going to ask me to quit smoking. And I said, I ain't promising you that. And she passed away, and that was tough. Her husband passed away. He got some kind of cancer that was fast growing. He passed away within the same year. My husband and I lost 2 of our best friends in the same year. Soon after that, my sponsor passed away. My Patsy went home. And 6 weeks later, my little sponsor that I love so much, been with me 6 years, she killed herself. She OD'd. And I thought, oh, God, this is more than I can handle. And it wasn't more than I can handle. The women in the program were so wonderful to me. They sponsored me back. You know, they weren't even going to have a service for her. She had made friends in these rooms, and they became her family. And we got together, and we paid for her to have a funeral. I mean, we do these things with people we love. We passed that basket for extra money. We bought her flowers. We talked the pastor into doing his service for free. And what little insurance she had from the nurses' union sent it to her son, and he had a cremated. 76 people showed up at that service, and it was awesome. They got up and said wonderful things about her, and we do that for you. We do that for you. You have become my family. I don't have any family here, but you have become my family, and I refuse to leave you people. I love you. Most of these people in these rooms are my friends. There are friends in this room that would lay down their life for me. I know one of them that would. I know one of them that would. And if you know just one person that loves you unconditionally, you're the richest man and woman in this room. Material things don't mean anything. And I'm going to show you a little joke about that. I am definitely not what I wear, honey. As y'all well know, I never have been. My little Spotsy down from San Diego, little Willa, she's so precious to me. She was saying, all you got is jeans and t-shirts. And I said, that's all I got, but I got these good jeans on tonight. I got my good t-shirt on tonight, honey. I got my earrings on that one of my Spotsy gave me. Ain't that pretty? I'm looking good. Went and got my hair done. She peeked in there and I said, the orange one or the green one? So if y'all don't like my outfit, she picked it out. And I told her I was going to blame it all on her. And I want to tell you something else that touched my heart. I know that I'm not what I wear, and I'm not where I live. I'm not what I drive. I'm just a lady who loves all of you. I love the young people in this program. Oh, my God, do I love you young people. There's a lady in this room, and she knows who she is. And she had not been to my house or just loved me just because I was me. I'm sitting there about a week before Christmas, and she slides this little box over to me. And in the middle of the meeting, I open up the box, and she's bought me a pair of shoes because she don't think I got no winter shoes. That, you just don't know what that did to me. I thought, honey, I got enough money to go buy 10 pair of these shoes. It's just not that important to me. Other things are important to me. I don't have to look good, honey. I like to look good. I'm still looking. I ain't never gonna get that old. If I get that old, just cut my head off and throw it in the grave. My brain is dead anyway. You know, but what I'm trying to say, in all things, if you stay in these rooms, if you keep coming back, you know, as long as you're sucking air, you have a chance. If people are curious to you and treat you less than respectful because you come to a meeting with a drink or you come to a meeting stoned, screw them. Go find somebody like me because you have a right to be here. You have a right to be here. If you don't stay here, you will die. And I'm a lady that doesn't want to lose one young person, one old fart like me in this program. I want you to keep coming. One of the miracles is my daughter has been drinking, and she was the biggest drug addict I've ever seen. She drove me nuts. She's coming to visit me. I have been praying for her for the last 19 years. She's sober 2 years last week. And she's going to a women's spiritual weekend, too. You know, she says, I don't know about this high power business. I said, I'm going to take you to a women's retreat. We're going to have fun. You're going to hear about all these women with a higher power that's having fun. And she's never been to anything like this before. She doesn't have a sponsor, and she hasn't worked the steps. I don't care. I will see she gets some good information while she's there. We'll plant that seed, and it will grow. And I have faith. I have faith that God will do for her what she cannot do for herself, because that's what he's done for me. I have a new attitude. I found a new freedom. I found a brand new happiness. And I'm still looking for Tom Cruise. Close to my age. I have hope. I have faith. And I have love for all alcoholics. And I am so glad to stand before you as the happy alcoholic. Thank you.